I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, books on marine life. Joining us, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning, Mindy.
And biologist Dennis Minsky, who's a naturalist on the dolphin, whale watch boats, and dune tours. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning.
So we picked our topic. Dennis, you want to say something before we get started here?
Well, I had a thought on the way down here, and I just wanted to share it. I want to say something because neither of you will say it. I'm speaking to the listeners out there that I have a birthday coming up, and it's a big number, and I'm old. I'm so old, I remember when T-shirts were white and sweatshirts were gray. No logos, no pictures of whales, no nothing. I remember when grown-ups didn't ride bicycles, and I remember before there were book groups, you know? But in the past 20 or 30 years or 40 years, book groups abound now.
Right.
And this is a book group. And you and Jill create a book group for all the people out there. And you do a great job. And I just wanted to say,
well,
I'm
glad
I'm
you could join us
here
for our book group.
Well,
this month.
I'm very glad. May I say, I have a birthday coming up too. What's your birthday? My birthday is Friday. I don't know when your birthday is.
I forget.
It you too. Forget. It too is a big birthday. So I'm delighted that you have a birthday coming up. And thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Oh, you're great, both of you.
All right, Jill, you're going to get us started with a Mary Oliver poem?
You know, you can't go wrong with starting with a Mary Oliver poem. I think Dennis would agree with me. And this is from actually her book called Dream Work. And what I was sort of surprised to find, having recently heard her interviewed in on Being with Krista Tippett, was that a lot of the poems that I didn't realize are not, they're not all in the new and selected poems. I mean, it's called selected for a reason. And so some of these I read in Dreamwork I had never read before. So here's one which seems appropriate to our topic. It's called Starfish. Starfish. In the sea rocks, in the stone pockets, under the tide's lip, in water dense as blindness, they slid like sponges, like too many thumbs. I knew this, and what I wanted was to draw my hands back from the water. What I wanted was to be willing to be afraid. But I stayed there. I crouched on the stone wall while the sea poured its harsh song through the sluices, while I waited for the gritty lightning of their touch, while I stared down through the tides leaving, where sometimes I could see them, their stubborn flesh lounging on my knuckles. What good does it do to lie all day in the sun, loving what is easy? It never grew easy, but at last I grew peaceful. All summer, my fear diminished as they bloomed through the water like flowers, like flecks of an uncertain dream, while I lay on the rocks, reaching into the darkness, learning little by little to love our only world.
Very nice.
So a little Mary Oliver to get us started.
Great.
And do you have any poetry, Dennis, that you want to share?
Okay. I brought my friend Elizabeth Bradfield, I read last time. If I have a theme in the pile of books in front of me, it is, a la Bob Finch, not so much the natural world, but the natural world overlapping with the human world. But so you'll see coming up. But here is Elizabeth Bradfield's new collection called Once Removed. She has also works on the dolphin, among other things. And I'll read sections of two poems. The first one's called Historic Numbers of Right Whales Skim Feeding Off Cape Cod. And I know, Mindy, you've been out there. Who would expect their appetite would come to seem ominous? But now I know they are voids of hunger. They plow a field of plankton, turn, plow again. They strip the water like loggers on a clear cut. The bay this spring seemed overrun by stern, enormous beetles. Black, vaguely military, inexorable. This must be how it was before. And then just from another one, and this goes more to my theme of what I'm going to, some of the other books are about, In the Inner Harbor. You can see the Chico Jess sunk dockside. Pilot house and deck glow through harbor water, shift with light, tide, and the seasons of plankton. Mast and radar flag up through chop, through sheen. Some say scuttled, but maybe just the natural fate of an old boat that's worked itself to rust and rot by working the waters through their fish. Down now to what once was trash, skates and dogs. Either way, it's tied to the pier where it sank, ringed by orange containment booms, still moored between the Carol Ann and the Jersey Princess. So,
Very nice. Yeah.
Lovely.
All right. So we have, there's really no subcategories in our
You might say we went different directions.
Different directions.
Absolutely.
Which is the beauty of the maritime marine theme.
Right. But I want to go with legendary creatures over here, Jill, just because you've got a couple of really interesting... You always come up with some interesting picks. So in this legendary creatures, we have Selkies, right?
We do have Selkies.
Which I never heard of before, I have to say.
Which I think is extraordinary. Living
mermaids,
living,
yes, Selkies, no,
yeah, and you know, having lived near the water as long as you have, I will say there's sort of a Scottish thing, you know. I think it's more Scottish than it is Cape Cod,
okay,
but however, I have no doubt somewhere, you know, we have Selkies as well. And what they are, let me just describe to you from Susan Cooper actually retold one of the tales, her picture book called The Selkie Girl, which also has beautiful illustrations by Warwick Cutten, speaks a little bit about what a Selkie is. And essentially, they're gray seals. This is what people believe, is that they are gray seals that people think are women. And when they come out of the sea, they become women. But there are a lot of rules about, if you're a Selkie, there are a lot of rules. So here's a little bit about one of the rules from this picture book called The Selkie Girl, retold by Susan Cooper. It's a long legend. I mean, you know, they go way back. Anyway, here you go. Old Thomas grinned down at him. You must wait until this same day next year, he said, at the seventh stream of the flood tide in spring. And if then you are still foolish enough to be in love, because one of the characters in this book is in love with this Selkie, you must go to that rock and steal the bundle that is beside the Selkie girl when she is out of the sea. For that is her skin, and without it, she cannot become a seal again. You must not destroy it, or she will die. But as long as you keep it safe and hidden, she will follow you and stay with you.
Wow.
So there's your basic, you know, what a Selkie is. But there are and the more I thought about it, the more I was thinking about all the Selkie-related things. So if you need a primer on Selkies, you can also, here are some other options for you. The Secret of Roan Inish, which was a film directed by John Sayles in 1994. Beautiful film, and it's all about Selkies. And
how did I miss that?
I don't. You must have been busy. You know, you must have been busy. There's also Louis Collins, who is a folk singer who was in the western part of the state. I don't know if she still is. But anyway, she wrote a beautiful song called The Ballad of the White Seal Maid. But the lyrics are based on a Jane Yolen poem. I bet you've heard of Jane Yolen. She's very prolific children's book and just in general author. Anyway, beautiful song. So there's that, too. You can listen to that. I'll put links up to all of this when we... but they're also... There also is this wonderful book called The People of the Sea, A Journey in Search of the Seal Legend by David Thompson, with an introduction by Seamus Haney. This actually was a reprint of something that was originally published in 1954, and Counterpoint Press republished it in 2000 with this new intro. And it's really funny because actually a friend of mine told me about that. I was talking about, you know, I'm going to be doing this show. What should I talk about? And he mentioned Selkies and specifically this book. And I was like, oh my God, I have that book on my shelf. That'll be easy. So, and it is really interesting about how this came about, because there's a radio connection in the intro. Who knew? So let me tell you about what David Thompson, who is the one who wrote this book originally. David Thompson's book is luminously its own thing. It has its origins in one man's rambles round the highlands and islands of Scotland and the west coast of Ireland in search of stories and folklore surrounding the Selkie, or gray Atlantic seal. It was written at a great moment in the history of radio during the 1940s and 1950s, when the BBC employed poets and writers to record and collect oral material and, most important, gave them permission to recreate it in a new artistic form. Consequently, it survives not as a period piece, but as a poetic achievement, one of whose works written by, quote, a man speaking to men, a man, it is true, endured with more lively sensibility, more enthusiasm and tenderness, who has a greater knowledge of human nature and a more comprehensive soul than are supposed to be common among mankind. so quite an intro. And that's what this is. It's essentially, it's a collection of his stories that he's putting down on paper that he has heard other people tell. So really a wonderful book, The People of the Sea, A Journey in Search of the Seal Legend by David Thompson.
Now, you've got these Selkie books. Did you bring any mermaid books?
Well, as a matter of fact, I did have one mermaid book, which I had to share, which is really, it's really a history book, but not per se of mermaids, but of a show in Florida that had underwater mermaids. It's called Weeki Wachee, City of Mermaids, A History of One of Florida's Oldest Roadside Attractions. And it talks about the connection between manatees and mermaids.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
that I've heard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
drunken somebody out at sea going, hey, there's a mermaid and it's a manatee. Right.
But what is so spectacular about this is all the photos and that he has put together. These women were actually doing their act underwater with breathing tubes going up to the top of the water. Huh. And it was a huge thing. I mean, Elvis apparently was there. And I mean, very, very big. And
well,
of course, it is really, it's really a gorgeous history of this particular place and the science behind how they were able to do this and how they originally it was just like girls from the neighborhood that this guy got together and said, okay, let's do a mermaid show. Anyway, really fascinating book. As one of the descriptions of it says, when swimsuit clad young women cavorted in the freshwater springs of Weeki Wachee, Florida in October 1947, it seemed so fantastic many visitors couldn't believe the performers were actually underwater. In this era before scuba, people were expected to drown if they stayed under for more than a few minutes. They certainly didn't dance ballet or eat bananas and drink soda pop underwater like the Weeki Wachee mermaids did. So for your very interesting take on mermaid books, this is great. Weeki Wachee, City of Mermaids.
All right. Dennis, you didn't bring any legendary creatures. What have you got for us?
No, back to reality here. I'm going to skip around, but back to reality. Since Jill mentioned the gray seals, I'm dealing with local talent. Liz Bradfield, local. Mm-hmm. Peter Troll needs no introduction, I think, to your listeners. His new book, The Gray Curtain, The Impact of Seals, Sharks, and Commercial Fishing on the Northeast Coast. It's a beautiful book. It's more of a photo essay. It's not long. But if you had any questions about gray seals, they will be answered in this book, including I was shocked to learn that the first pups were found in 1988 in Muskeget, 1990 in Monomoy. So this is a recent phenomenon. And then he gets into the political debate about the effect of seals on fishing, which mm-hmm. we've all heard, and I'm not here to go into politics. But here's from the introduction. Here on Cape Cod, and in the minds of many commercial fishermen along the New England coastline, the gray seal has played a part in the decline of the commercial fishery. Has this large, protected, fish-eating marine mammal become a scapegoat? Has the decades-long, and this is the quote I love, more fish, more money, bigger boat, more fish, more money, bigger boat, philosophy of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s finally caught up with the commercial fishermen? Or has the rapid and continuing expansion of the gray seal along the Cape shoreline come at the expense of commercial fishermen? Now, right there, he sets the whole discussion of the book. Mm-hmm. Seals versus overfishing and so on. This is the first time that I've seen a cogent argument, and again, I'm not here for politics, mm-hmm. but he quotes a few commercial fishermen who themselves are very articulate, argument for the management, quote-unquote, of seals. It's a long way off.
A discussion for another day.
Exactly. But anyhow,
this is lovely photos in that book as well.
Beautiful book, informative book.
Get the conversation going, that's for sure.
Yeah.
We're talking about books on marine life. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to add to our list. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about books on marine life with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and biologist Dennis Minsky, naturalist on the Dolphin Whale Watch Boats and Dune Tours. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to add a book to our list. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we will have a link on our website to the list of books we talk about today a little later this morning at capeandislands.org. Dennis, what have you got? You got another fishing book there?
Keeping up with the by local talent. This is a book called Nautical Twilight by J.J. Dutra. Actually, it's Judy Dutra, whom I know. And subtitled The Story of a Cape Cod Fishing Family. On the cover is the Richard and Arnold, which was their boat. And I was sitting in this boat a week ago. It was right next to the dolphin boats. They're on the way to Florida now. They no longer fish, which is part of the story. But again, I don't want to get into the politics of commercial fishing, but this book gives a real sense of what it's like to fish. She says...
And when you say fishing, do you mean fishing to make a living or
fishing to fish? Yeah. So just, she says, for most of the year-round population, a ride down the town wharf is integrated into the day. We go to look at the boats, the wharves, and harbor. During the winter months, while our boat was hauled out of the water, 50 or 60 boats were still making a living bringing in whiting, codfish, sea scallops, and a variety of other edible products from the sea. And that is so true that I know in Provincetown, and I'm sure in every fishing town, many people go down to the wharf every day just mm-hmm. to look and see what things are doing. And then here's a little bit of a sense of what it's like to fish. Having a practical sense of the laws of physics and knowing what's on the bottom are important in fishing. Where the wrecks are, where the big rocks are, how fast to tow, and how to get huge bags aboard, lifting thousands of pounds over the rail without rolling the boat over. The conditions of the sea are part of the knowledge needed to keep a fishing boat working well. And then there's just on and on, just details of what it's like to be on the water.
It's a hard job, that's for sure.
Yeah, one... Yeah, I don't know, I had another one. But yeah, it's really a wonderful book. She's a new writer, and it's charming and real.
All right. Jill, what have you got?
Well, I could not have had a better segue than what Dennis just gave me, which is I brought a cookbook because, you know, those fishes that are being caught, many people eat. And I found this book. In fact, this is so old. The stamp inside this says Falmouth Free Public Library. And it's been a long time since we've been called the Falmouth Free Public Library. But this, although may I say we are still Free Public Library. This is called The Cape Cod Cookbook by Suzanne Carey Groover. It came out in 1930, published by Little Brown and Company. I mean, you know, major publisher. And it has some great fish recipes in it. And as you can imagine, probably the section on fish in this cookbook is the biggest section in the book. But she also has these, and I want to know if either of you or any of our listeners have ever heard this, is how to test fresh fish.
Okay.
You're with me here?
Yeah, okay. Follow you so far.
If fish is fresh, The eyes will be bright and bulging. Mm-hmm. The flesh, when pressed with the finger, will be elastic. The gills, the fringe-like appendage each side of the head, will be bright red. Fresh fish, if dropped into water, will sink. If the fish floats, it is unfit for use.
The so gills part, I didn't know about the gills part, but the other stuff part. I've heard, yeah.
And then she has suggestions on how to freshen salt fish. Cover mm-hmm. the fish with water and let stand flesh side down overnight. And then she goes on from there. But she also has lots of cod recipes. Mm-hmm. She's got codfish cakes with bacon, codfish balls. Provincetown is the name of this recipe. Creamed codfish, scalloped cod with cheese, codfish souffle, cod tongues. Anybody Ooh. Eating cod tongues?
And it's not really the tongue.
As these are usually salted, they must be soaked overnight. Drain. Boil 10 minutes in fresh water. Serve with a good butter sauce. If preferred, fried. Wash them well to remove salt. Dip into flour and fry in butter. So you've got And then, oh my gosh, your description of broiling the broiled live lobster is not for the faint-hearted.
Uh-oh.
Oh my gosh, the lobster loses nothing in flavor and is far more easily handled by being boiled a short time before being split in two down the back. Discard the stomach and intestines. Remove the coral and green substance, which is the liver. I have to say, I never knew that was, I know it's there, but I never knew it was liver. And spread upon an oiled broiler and rub over with melted butter or oil. Have the shell side toward the flame for about 15 minutes, then turn the flesh side and cook 5 minutes. Lift broiler from time to time to prevent scorching. Melt half a cup of butter and stir in the liver.
Oh, boy.
Mince the coral and use with the butter as a sauce poured over the lobster when serving. Anyway, this is really fascinating about how people were eating in the 1930s on Cape Cod. And she also has fried pickerel ever? Does anyone eat pickerel anymore?
Fried, no.
Prepare and clean the fish, cut into pieces for individual serving, dip each piece in milk, grill in flour, sprinkle with salt, fry in hot. Deep hot fat. Mm-mm. So
well, deep hot fat.
Anyway.
My goodness. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Lots of fish treats in here.
All right.
So,
Dennis, what have you got?
I have a book. I'm not going to spend a long time on it because it is so well known, but it is, if you could, the listeners at home would see it's festooned with little stickets because there's so much good information. Cod by Mark Kurlansky. Subtitle, A Biography of the Fish That Changed the World. And in fact, it did. I learned in this book that cod allowed the Norsemen to traverse the ocean 1,000 years ago, that there were so many cod in the sea that they actually blocked sailing vessels. They were so thick that salt cod, inferior salt cod, were sent to the Caribbean to feed the slaves. It was part of the slave trade.
Wow.
That the Union Army lived on cod. I mean, that it was
dried
one of the
cod,
reasons
presumably.
Why the North prevailed. And I also learned some interesting fact, like cod meat has virtually no fat, 0.3%, and has more than 18% protein, which is unusually high even for fish. And when cod is dried, more than 80% of its flesh evaporates. It becomes concentrated protein.
Hmm.
So this is an amazing... I also learned that between 1960 and 1970, bird's eye got involved up in the Newfoundland and Northern Mass, and fish sticks, which was the only fish mm-hmm. I had ever heard of when I grew up, tripled. Between 1960 and 1970, the sale of fish sticks tripled. But then, so he goes into the whole decline of the fishery of cod, which, again, most people are familiar with. And it's beautifully done. And finally, he says, he's up in Gloucester. Miles from the Gloucester Harbor are at the hotels along the rocky New England coastline. Tourists eat their breakfast and plan their day. Many of the tourists are planning to go whale watching. They talk of whales as adorable pets. how they flop and dive and make a real snoring noise. On this rugged coastline where fortunes were once made hunting whales, whale watching has become a prosperous business during the tourism months. The skippers of the whale watching boats are usually out of work fishermen. That's true in Provincetown, too. There's a big difference between living in a society that hunts whales and living in one that views them. Nature is being reduced to precious demonstrations for entertainment and education, something far less natural than hunting. Are we headed for a world where nothing is left of nature but parks?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's arguing for return to whaling, but he's just saying we've lost an elemental interaction with nature, which is what fishermen are all about.
Right.
They interact with the environment. They have to know the environment. And
it's part of the appeal of fishing is to be part of the, you know.
Yeah, and it's a terrific educational book.
All right. Jill.
Well, another great segue. Thank you very much, Dennis, which is
that
I brought a lot of recipes, and I've brought another cookbook, which is about as far away from the other cookbook as you can get. This is actually called North, the New Nordic Cuisine of Iceland by Gunnar Gislason and Jody Eddy. And of course, in Iceland, they do still eat whale. It's very controversial. He addresses that actually in this book. He has a little section called Taboo Foods.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes, horse meat and whale meat are consumed in many households in Iceland. They are extremely controversial foods that incite emotional responses from tourists who see items such as horse sausage, horse steaks, smoked whale, and whale steaks on restaurant menus, or discover whale jerky for sale in souvenir shops. But what he also does in here is he has an interview with a fisherman. And this is a fisherman whose parents did not want him to be a fisherman. The whole family had been fishermen. And he is asked the question, why did you make the decision to move to Grimsey and fish? And he responds, I was the youngest child, and my parents let my older brothers get away with a lot. Each one fished on the Bering Sea for 10 years, and my parents were always worried about them. With me, they were much more protective and wouldn't let me do anything. Now, I'm a fisherman, and I have all the freedom I want. The fishing tradition is ingrained in our society. It's in our blood, and it's who we are. I am at peace now that I'm out on the water. I feel connected to my ancestors in a way I never would have if I made the decision to work in a cubicle my entire life. I get back to Reykjavik 3 to 4 times a year, but that's enough. I like my life now. It's a great interview. And by the way, it's also a cookbook, so there are lots of recipes.
Okay, let's talk to Rich, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Rich.
Hello.
Hi.
So my favorite fishing nautical book is, and I don't know if it's been discussed, is The Hungry Ocean by Linda Greenlaw.
Oh, no, we haven't mentioned that one. Hungry Ocean. Yep. Yeah, she's a good writer.
You know, Linda Greenlaw is a sword fishing, you know, captain, and I think that is her first. She's written many books, but her first book, I think, is the best. We're going out sword fishing, and just a fascinating sort of snapshot of, you know, a month on the water and what sword fishermen do going out to the Grand Banks and off Nova Scotia, and just the whole logistics and everything of it. I think it's just a great book to look for people to read.
Yeah, definitely. We'll put that on our list. Rich, thanks. Thanks for the suggestion. That's a good one.
I remember a quote from her when she tried lobstering for a while, and she would talked about changing the water in the traps when they came up empty. Changed the water in the traps.
And she also wrote a cookbook after that.
Oh,
but you're
that.
Absolutely right, yeah. Rich, that her first book was her best.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to add a book to our list. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What's your next book, Dennis?
Well, the Cod book is quite familiar, but I have one that's less familiar, and it's a beautiful little book called Consider the Eel by a guy named Richard Schweid. Now, I know, Mindy, you... the woman mentioned eating eel yesterday in Amsterdam. It is mind-boggling how popular eel is all around the world, from Ireland to Spain to Japan. People just go nuts for eels, as we did here at one time. And for some reason, which is really not totally understood. By the way, there's lots of unknowns about eel biology yet. Hmm. Do you know who the first person was to establish that male eels had testes?
Who?
Is something I do not know, Dennis.
A young medical student named Sigmund Freud.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. Back when medicine and science were a little more but my favorite quote from this book, and this is just wonderful. You learn a lot about eels and a lot about people. The pilgrims, by the way, who were clueless when they landed here, didn't know how to fish, didn't know how to hunt, didn't know how to do anything. But they survived on eels, among other things, but as did many early people. But he says something about people would rather catch a cold than catch an eel. really, really wonderful book. And you'll learn a lot about eels and about the history of human culture. Eels might have been the very first fish ever caught by people.
Have you eaten eel before?
I have. Smoked eel, yeah.
Have you?
No. Nor may I say in this 1930-something cookbook, are there any eel recipes, which means people must have stopped eating. I mean, they could have been catching eels here in the 1930s, yes?
Yeah, I would think.
No?
Yeah, they're still very plentiful. I caught lots of eels in the Hudson River when I worked down there and kept them in tanks, and they're marvelous creatures.
All right, Jill, what have you got?
Well, I have another book, one of my favorite. This is actually one of my all-time favorite reference books, but it also there is definitely a maritime connection. This is called An Exaltation, of Larks, by James Lipton. Now, many of you, and I have to say, as a reference librarian who knew this book way, way, way before James Lipton's second career,
his TV career,
as TV host on Inside the Actor's Studio on the Bravo Network, I was like shocked when I made the connection that James Lipton
was the same
James Lipton who wrote my favorite reference book. How is this even possible? But he is a guy that loves language. And this book, An Exaltation of Larks, is appropriate to this topic because it tells you all the collective words for things. So, for example, something as basic, and these, he has this broken up into sections. There's the known and the unknown. In the known, you get a school of fish, for example. And then he gives you the history of where that expression came from. You have a gam of whales, which I'm sure Dennis is familiar. Do you still refer to them as a gam?
I would have thought pod.
Never heard of it. Yeah. Gam.
Oh, well, see, now this is interesting because what this says is, it also has these gorgeous illustrations, sort of 19th century illustrations. A whaling voyage could last as long as 3 years. So when two whalers encountered each other on some remote sea, it called for a gam, an exchange of crews via whaleboats and the gamming chair. It was a happy time for a whaleman, and obviously the whale's habit of sporting playfully on the surface of the sea gave rise to this fanciful term. But what you're saying is you think of it as a pod, and he does have below this a school of porpoises and a pod of seals. And it says the reference to peas in a pod is obvious. Pod was applied by sailors to seals and small groups of whales. So who knows, you know? I can't argue with James Lipton, but if you want to go ahead. But then he also has in here the sort of fanciful things as well as the unknown. And so he has a fine kettle of fish, a glint of goldfish, a shiver of sharks. I like that one. A scuttle of crabs and a flaccidity of clams.
So how many makes a shiver of sharks? Do we know that?
I do not know that. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, one.
Probably.
You're right,
that's
one.
That's right.
Especially if it's a great white.
Anyway, this is a beauty. There was a new edition put out. I have the original edition. This is the new Penguin Books. In the ultimate edition is what this called. So he added a lot more text and so forth and so on. The original is still the pristine, beautiful version. This is very nice, though. And nice, clean, paperback, beautiful.
All right.
Great, great present.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to add to our list of marine books, marine life books. The point at capeandislands.org is our email address, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about books on marine life with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and biologist Dennis Minsky, who's a naturalist on the Dolphin Whale Watch Boats and Dune Tours. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to suggest a book for our list. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dennis, what's your next book?
My next book is a book called The Sea Inside by Philip Hoare, who is, full disclosure, a friend of mine. And he's been on the Cape many times. And when people ask me, well, what are his books about? It's impossible to answer. Reading a Philip Hoare book is like being with the most hyper-caffeinated, brilliant person you can. So here's what this book's about. This is very short. It's about Southampton, oyster catchers, crows, container ships, submarines, swans, the theory of aquatic apes, which is baloney, his seagoing ancestors, one involved in human trafficking in Ceylon, another one lost crossing the Great Plains in America, the Isle of Wight, Thomas Burton, peregrine falcons, seabirds, London, Benjamin Franklin, who was obsessed with swimming, as is Philip, shearwaters, sperm whales, the autopsy of a harbor porpoise, beaked whales, on and on and on. It just goes. That's just a bit of it.
So
I'll read one little passage when he's swimming with sperm whales. Suddenly, their number is dramatically swollen. A huge female with an additional two calves twirling around to appear out of the turquoise gloom. I sing to myself as I'm caught up in the crowd. I've never shared the water with so many whales. There are whales across the entirety of my vision, wall-to-wall whales wending this way and that, perpendicular, horizontal, vertical columns in the sea. And it goes on. But a wild ride.
But covering all the topics, do you feel like you ever get lost? Is he switching topics or is it?
Oh, yeah, you can get lost. But it's a fun ride. And he's just got such an interesting mind it's always fun.
Yeah. Jill?
I brought a book called Sea Fever, The True Adventures That Inspired Our Greatest Maritime Authors, from Conrad to Masefield, Melville, and Hemingway, by a guy named Sam Jefferson, who I knew nothing about, but this sounded really interesting, so I picked it up. And in his intro, he starts with a quote from Edgar Allan Poe, "If you have never been at sea in a heavy gale, you can form no idea of the confusion of mind occasioned by wind and spray together. They blind, deafen, and strangle you and take away all power of action or reflection." And then he goes on to say in this intro, "Given that our oceans and seas cover about 2/3 of the planet's surface, it is hardly surprising that their influence has always run strongly through literature. The waters of this world have swirled through storytelling ever since the Anglo-Saxons spun the tale of Beowulf and Homer narrated the Odyssey." And he does go, one of the nice things about this book, I have so much literary criticism these days, is almost unreadable because it's all, I mean, apologies to all those academics out there who write great things, but not necessarily for the general reader. This is great because he's really written it for the general reader. As he himself says, it's not as quote unquote earnest critique. He's just talking from the heart. And he has chapters on all these different people: Erskine Childers, Joseph Conrad, James Fenimore Cooper, Ernest Hemingway. I mean, all the, you know, your major sea writers. And he's got, of course, Melville in here. And here's a little bit of what he writes on Melville. "If ever there was a man who suffered for his art, it was Herman Melville. The reason so much of his seafaring prose evokes scenes so vividly is that much of what he described, he lived through." Mm-hmm. And it talks about how Melville, you know, how much time he spent on whaling ships. Anyway, a really lovely book. Will give you lots of more places to go with your maritime reading.
All right.
Wow.
Dennis, what have you got next?
I want that one. This book is not for everyone. It was recommended to me by Liz Bradfield. It's called The Log from the Sea of Cortez, and it's by none other than John Steinbeck. Hmm. Who knew that John Steinbeck was a marine guy? But this book was written in 1940. It's about a six-week collecting trip down to the Gulf of California, which is otherwise known as the Sea of Cortez.
And somebody wrote a poem about that as well, and I don't know. I don't think it was her. But anyway, go on. I'm sorry. Go
well, yeah, it's poem worthy. So I don't even know how to describe this book. It's a journal. It's a log. It's full of philosophical musings, a lot of information because they collected in all these tide pools. And his friend was a man named Ed Ricketts from Monterey, who was a big marine biologist. But he is so well-versed in marine biology, but all kinds of very precious. And the whole thing is it's 1940, mm-hmm. and there are references to the war. But there, he says, that the great world fell away from us because there's six guys on a boat. There's a lot of drinking, but they also do a lot of collecting. And just one, and also 1940, some of these natives, the Mexicans down there, had barely seen people. And he says, we had known that sooner or later we must develop an explanation for what we were doing, which would be short and convincing. How can you say to a people who are preoccupied with getting enough food that you have come to pick up useless little animals so that perhaps your world picture will be enlarged? That didn't even convince us. Mm. So it's a very wise, interesting, zany. It's very much like Philip Hoare in 1940. John Steinbeck was a predecessor in a way because he's all over the place. Descriptions of marine life, philosophy about science, about civilization. And it just boggled my mind. I'm very, very thankful to Liz for turning me on to this book.
And imagine it's areas where he's collecting have changed a lot. So a lot of that marine life he's collecting may not even be there anymore.
he mentions that, too. And while he's there, a Japanese shrimping boat comes in and just cleans out the area. Hmm. And he's very much aware of environmental disaster headed our way. Oh. And he also talks about the difference between, he says, it would be interesting to try to explain to one of these Indians our tremendous projects, our great drives, the fantastic production of goods that can't be sold, the clutter of possessions which enslave whole populations with debt, the worry and neuroses that go into the rearing and educating of neurotic children who find no place for themselves in this complicated world, on and on and on.
That sounds
fun.
Interesting. Yeah,
yeah, it's a wild ride. Anyhow.
Chill.
I brought along with me something I discovered in the local history collection at the Falmouth Public Library, which has been sitting there for years. I just never had picked it up. And it's called Cape Cod Magazine and appears to have been published in the 1920s. The copy I'm holding in my hand here is January 15th, 1928, for 20 cents. Mm-hmm. You got this beautiful, just the artwork on the cover. It's beautiful drawing of Cape Cod. But you know what? We are sitting in Woods Hole, and they do a lot of studying, I understand, here. And there's a whole article in this 1928 issue called Where Scientists Study Sea Life, Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, Scene of Most Unusual Research by somebody named William F. Furbush. And it begins the completion last June of the two new dormitories of the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole calls public attention to this institution anew and presents fitting opportunity for a description of the laboratory and its general purpose of service to mankind. The new buildings were erected at a cost of $250,000, a sum which was the gift of the General Education Board of New York City, which I have to say was something I never knew that that's an interesting story in and of itself. Anyway, this magazine has all kinds. There is a whole article in another issue, June 15th, 1926, on eating whale meat. Mm-hmm. So if you want to know more about Cape Cod and eating whale meat, there's also August 1st, 1926, sleuthing slippery mackerel at Woods Hole. And there is this lovely photo. It's hauling the nets in the early morning off the Nashon Shore, Woods Hole. These things, I mean, there's just gold in these things. Yeah. It is absolutely, they're beautiful. And there's a whole series of articles on what we eat on Cape Cod, which is what got me into the Cape Cod eating cookbooks. So really, come take a look. I hope if it's not digitized, it will be soon.
Yeah, you definitely want to keep that. What have you got, Dennis?
Speaking of Woods Hole, this book, I said to Bob Finch, we're doing Marine Life. He said, well, you have to talk about The Sea Around Us, Rachel Carson. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Bob. I am holding, I'll hold it up to the radio, to the mic, the illustrated commemorative edition of The Sea Around Us by Rachel Carson. I highly recommend this book. It is three books in one. She wrote this book in 1951. She wrote a second edition in 1961. And then the preface to this book is by Robert Ballard, a name you might know, in 2013. In 1951, it was amazing what they knew and what they didn't know. Again, many references to Woods Hole. She talks a lot about rising seas. She talks about increased temperature, climate change, but not a single reference to a greenhouse effect or increase in carbon dioxide or methane or anything like that. But just I learned so much, and I had forgotten what a beautiful writer she is. The sentences, I mean, and there's a chapter on tides and one's on current and the deep water trenches, just beautifully written. And go back to Rachel Carson because she's great. Yeah. So thanks, Bob, for that.
Jill.
Do we have some time for one more Mary Oliver?
Yeah, we've
got time.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Another Mary Oliver poem from DreamWorks, this one called Clamming.
Oh, yeah.
I rise by lamplight and hurry out to the bay where the gulls like white ghosts swim in the shallows. I rake and rake down to the gray stones, the clenched quahogs, the deadweight fruits of the sea that bear inside their walls, a pink and salty, one-lunged life. We are all one family, but love ourselves best. Later, I sit on the dawn-soaked shore and set a thin blade into the slightly hissing space between the shells and slash through the crisp life muscle. I put what is in the shell into my mouth, and when the gulls come begging, I feed them too. How detailed and hopeful, how exact everything is in the light on the rippling sand, at the edge of the turning tide, its upheaval, its stunning proposal, its black, anonymous roar.
And we have some suggestions from Jean for some good books for kids. Let's see, she's got Bert Dowd Deep, Waterman by Robert McCloskey, Down, 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 A Journey to the Bottom of the Sea, a book by Steve Jenkins. And then she says The Deep by Claire Novian, amazing coffee table book of deep sea creatures. That sounds like a nice book to look at. Finally, we got about 30 seconds, Jill, if you want to.
Well, I just want to mention that I'm not all about fantasy. There is a great field guide to North Atlantic wildlife, marine mammals, seabirds, fish, and other sea life put out by Yale University Press. It's got great illustrations, great information, a introduction, which has to do a lot with cod and how fishing has changed everything, you know, how the world is changing, as Dennis mentioned at the beginning of the show. Really beautiful book, and I highly recommend A Field Guide to North Atlantic Wildlife by Proctor and Lynch.
All right. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, biologist Dennis Minsky, naturalist on the dolphin whale watch boats and dune tours. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point with production assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.